I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to Radio Times. New Jersey is getting closer to legalizing recreational marijuana, and if it's approved, the state would be the 11th plus the District of Columbia to approve recreational cannabis. The legislation was okayed by both Senate and Assembly committees and is now before the legislature, and depending on what's in and what's out, could be signed by Governor Phil Murphy in the not-too-distant future. We asked Peyton Guyon to join us. He's investigative reporter who is covering cannabis for NJ Advance Media to get us up to speed. And Peyton, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So what is in this legislation?
So the basic run through is that it would legalize the possession and personal use of less than an ounce of cannabis for people 21 and over in the state of New Jersey. It also has some provisions to set up a commercial market, so companies that were licensed by the state would get to grow, process, and sell marijuana, as well as some expungement language, which would offer people who have low-level marijuana convictions the ability to clear those records, since what they have a conviction for would now be legal in the state of New Jersey.
And I want to pick up on all of that. Who is behind this legislation in New Jersey?
The prime candidate who's been really pushing this is State Senator Nicholas Cotari. He's been working on this behind the scenes for several years, and really kind of came last year in 2017 with a piece of legislation a little more than a year ago. And then with Governor Murphy's election, that was obviously something the governor had campaigned on, so it came to the fore this year.
There is some question about how much it would be taxed. Where does that stand?
So that's actually the biggest impasse we've got right now in terms of where the legislature is versus where the governor is. Senate President Steve Sweeney has really kind of stuck to his guns on this and said he doesn't want to see a tax a penny over 12%. While Murphy, we don't know exactly where he is right now, but in the past he's proposed something closer to 25%.
Which is obviously more than twice 12%. Where do you think that will go?
I guess it comes down to a couple of things. One, if Sweeney is at all able to or willing to negotiate that, I think the governor would be willing to come down some. The Senate president, he has not really shown any willingness to do that so far. Another area where that could happen is maybe an area where municipalities could increase the local tax they're able to charge. So let's say, the bill right now says something like 2% these municipalities could charge on top of the state 12%. If they could get something like 5% to where we're looking at a total tax of 17%, that might be something the governor would be willing to do.
Do we know how much money is at stake here?
So obviously, it depends on. We're basing all of this on estimations of the market. I mean, we've had economic groups and cannabis advocates estimate that New Jersey's market in the first, once the industry's up and running in the first year, something like $1 billion. So at 25%, we're talking $250 million. At 12%, we're talking $120 million. So obviously, I mean, there's a lot of money, in that divide.
When you said a billion, I'm on the radio, so you couldn't see my face, but I was pretty shocked. Is that based on Colorado numbers, for instance?
To some extent. I think Colorado and some of the other states, Oregon, Washington, the estimations are based on the market size there. New Jersey is not quite double, but close, roughly double Colorado in population. And then you got to consider, we've also got where you guys are in Philly. We've got New York, where neither of those states would have legalized recreational markets. So New Jersey, the estimations include hundreds of thousands of people coming across the rivers to buy in New Jersey.
Would that be legal?
It would be legal if they. This is kind of a funny question, because it's legal for them to cross and purchase in New Jersey, but it would be totally illegal still for them to cross the border. That would be that would still fall under actually crossing borders falls under federal crime. But if someone from Philly were able to come across the bridge, buy in New Jersey, had a private residence where they could consume, stay with a friend, whatever it may be, perfectly legal. But if they cross the border back into Pennsylvania with the cannabis, no longer legal.
Kind of like the liquor laws, right?
Similar to.
Are municipalities interested in either setting up lounges or bars or dispensaries? What's been the response from local governments?
So the overwhelming response we've seen, and overwhelming may be a strong way to put it, but the response we've seen so far from municipalities are from the ones that are ideologically opposed or have governments that are ideologically opposed to legalization. So I published a story last week counting more than 50 towns in New Jersey that have already taken some sort of step to preemptively ban marijuana businesses. And that's something that's allowed in the bill that we've seen. They wouldn't be able to prevent their residents from going somewhere else in the state to purchase it and then consume it in the town. But there is a provision that would allow any town that doesn't want to have a dispensary or a cultivation facility to ban that. But of course, they wouldn't get any tax revenue from that if they did decide to ban.
Are there critics? I mean, besides some of these municipalities that don't want it sold within their borders, are there still critics to recreational marijuana in New Jersey?
Yeah, and one of the biggest critics, and it may be a surprise to some folks, is a state senator from Newark named Ron Rice, and he's really been active with the opposition groups in pushing some of what I would still refer to as maybe some outdated information about marijuana. But he also feels that since the war on drugs has largely been waged on the backs of disadvantaged communities, urban communities, and he represents some of those, he feels that the legal market also would take advantage of some of these communities. So he's kind of got a couple of different reasons why he's opposed to it, but he's been working hard to talk with some of his colleagues in the state Senate to try to push what he thinks would happen and inform them of that. So right now we're kind of at a point where the votes seem to be there, but we do not have enough concrete yeses for me to go ahead and predict that as soon as it comes up in the legislature that it would pass.
That's Peyton Guyon. He's investigative reporter covering cannabis for NJ Advanced Media, talking about some legislation that would legalize recreational marijuana in the Garden State, what its status is. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Peyton's going to be with us for about the next 5 minutes, so if you are a New Jersey resident, we would love to hear from you. I'm curious, Peyton, though, what about people who have been arrested for small possessions of marijuana or even selling small amounts of marijuana that might be considered legal if this legislation is passed? What happens to those people? And you mentioned the word expungement.
So let me start, I guess, by separating the folks who have the distribution convictions versus the folks who have the low-level possession convictions. The bill, and there are a couple of different bills being contemplated. One, the main legalization bill, has some expungement provisions, but then other lawmakers have been working on standalone expungement that would help make the process easier. Right now, the main idea that's being contemplated is really talking about these folks who have the possession convictions. We could get to a point where we see some of the lower level distribution convictions in play too. But at the moment, it's mainly possession. And what would happen is they would be able to apply to expunge that, which is essentially clearing it as though it never happened. But one of the things I've spent a lot of time investigating and reporting on is New Jersey's expungement process is extremely burdensome and pretty slow. The state can't even tell me how many expungements that they grant in a year. They can tell me they received about 10,000 in 2017, but based on what they're telling me, they have no idea how many they grant every year. Experts tell me it's not very many.
Well, so obviously that the burden then is on the person who, I guess, has the record and what to do about that. Let me read an email from Kyle. He says, in October 2018, University of Montreal published research in the American Journal of Psychiatry on the lasting effects on adolescent cognitive development from using cannabis. What would this law do about preventing teenagers from using cannabis?
So, I mean, the law is very clear that people 21 and up are the only ones legally allowed to purchase. The businesses that have licenses from the state or that would have licenses from the state would certainly risk losing those if they're caught selling to people under 21. It would still be illegal for people under 21 to possess, use any of those things. So the law doesn't change a lot in terms of it still being illegal for people under 21. There are some advertising provisions that it can't be marketed in areas that kids would be watching. But I mean that has been a big concern in some of the states that have already legalized.
Here's a tweet from Jay. I purchased medical marijuana in New Jersey yesterday at $50 an ounce. Embarrassingly poor quality medicine that proves that the current dispensary model is failing. Since we have you, Peyton, what's the status then on medical marijuana in New Jersey?
Glad you asked. And there are a couple of updates I can give. In the same vein of legislation, there's also a medical marijuana expansion bill that its fate is really very tied to the legalization bill. So we probably won't see any action on that until there's action taken on the main recreational bill. But just this week, the Department of Health announced there would be 6 new medical marijuana dispensaries coming to New Jersey, and that doubles the number we've got now. We've only had 6 now for the past several years, and actually the 6th one just opened this year. So it's, you know, that's a big boost to the program. But just since Governor Murphy took office in January, the medical marijuana program has more than doubled in size in terms of the number of patients. And now we're approaching about 40,000 patients. So there have been supply issues. There have been long lines. These dispensaries are much needed, and there will be more needed than just those.
What about cash? And in many ways, this is a cash business. And I know in Colorado, there are problems about what to do with all the money, all the profits from selling marijuana. Is there a solution in New Jersey, Peyton?
At the moment, the cash issue is one that's really hard to get around. One of the areas that it can be a little easier is that in-state credit unions are able to lend a little more freely than the big banks. But in terms of how you can pay at the at the dispensaries, it has to be cash because none of the big credit card or debit card providers are willing to take on the risk since they're federally responsible and at the moment with federal prohibition still on the books, it's tough. So, in Colorado, they've had to figure out things, ways to deposit all that cash. And there have certainly been stories that we would hope wouldn't be repeated in New Jersey where, some of these cash drop-offs have been robbed and stuff like that. So it's really tricky. And it's one of the many areas where the breakdown between federal law and then the changing state laws causes a problem for the people in the states where it's been legalized.
Well, Peyton Guyon, thanks so much for joining us, frankly, getting us up to speed on the latest about recreational marijuana in New Jersey. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Love to come back.
We'll probably have you back. And he's an investigative reporter covering cannabis for NJ Advanced Media. After this short break, CBD. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine. What's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We were just talking about New Jersey legalizing recreational marijuana, and now we want to focus on a chemical that occurs naturally in the cannabis plant called CBD. It doesn't deliver the high of THC and is being promoted to treat a number of physical and psychological conditions, things like pain and anxiety, addiction, seizures, insomnia, inflammation. Problem is, CBD is unregulated, meaning its claims have not been scientifically tested, and the labels don't necessarily match the dosage, and CBD-infused products can be very expensive. We have two guests who have joined us. Marcel Bon Miller joining us by telephone. He's a psychologist, also adjunct assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. He teaches, he researches medical marijuana. Marcel Bon Miller, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Max Tuttleman. He's chairman of Smart Industry, CEO of Bouquet, that's a CBD company. He's associate fellow at Thomas Jefferson University, and he's been doing research on cannabis being used to deal with opiate and alcohol withdrawal. Max Tuttleman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Marcia, let me begin with you, and let's just get some basic information on the table before we really dig in here. Tell us, what is CBD?
Sure. So CBD, it's a molecule found within the cannabis plant, one of over 120 that are in there. It's probably the second most abundant one in the plant. And it's very different from THC, which is the most abundant. That's kind of what produces that high feeling when you smoke cannabis or use cannabis orally. And CBD, you know, like you said, has been touted as a potential therapeutic for lots of different conditions. And so there's a lot of interest and excitement about it going forward right now.
But it seems like we're at the very beginning stages, Marcel, of really understanding its effectiveness dealing with all these various conditions, correct?
We are. Yeah, we know very little about it. Even the mechanisms of action or the kind of, the ways in which it works in the body, we're still uncovering at this point.
Max, let me get you. How do you see CBD?
You know, I agree with Marcel. I've actually been reading all of his papers since I've gotten into this industry, and he's really one of the leading thought leaders on all of this. It's, we're really just starting to understand the different photocannabinoids and compounds that are in the cannabis and hemp plants, and we're really starting to see what these different compounds can do in understanding their value and the pharmacokinetics behind them, and really just what types of medicines can be derived and what can't. We're seeing a lot of advanced scientific work being done by people just taking the different compounds mm-hmm. and attaching it to different carriers and bringing medicines to market, but not really knowing or understanding how these compounds are working. So, really having a scientific knowledge and understanding at the basic level of this plant, we probably know more about the lavender plant or the aloe plant than we do about cannabis.
Does that worry you?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. But it also shows that, it's going to be over the next 20, 30 years, we're going to have room for amazing researchers to do groundbreaking work and really show us, the pathway forward.
Let me ask you a couple of personal questions.
Of course.
Because you used CBD to help your withdrawal from an opioid addiction that you had. Help us understand what was going on and why you turned to CBD.
Well, I saw that CBD was helping with some of the different symptoms that were occurring from withdrawal. And then I really started to, dig into the research. I'm very autodidactical and, I have this associate fellowship at Jefferson, but at the end of the day, I'm really just in the library researching. I'm not in a lab like guys like Marcel, but, right. Really starting to understand that, the therapeutic benefits of cannabis oil in treating addiction were really seen in the late 1800s. And they were treating opiate addiction and alcohol withdrawal symptoms with cannabis oil. And, we have the American College of Physicians here in Philadelphia has one of the most incredible libraries of scientific knowledge. And Jefferson University as well has this incredible library of just scientific research. And, I've been going into these libraries and trying to find the original apothecaric recipes in hopes of really enacting a real, true clinical research study one day under this.
I mean, it sounds like there's some interesting historical research, but for you, at least personally, anecdotally, how do you know it was a CBD that helped you
kick this
addiction that you had?
By no means I think the CBD helped me kick the addiction. I think there's multiple different forms of medicated-assisted treatment and different forms of psychotherapy that help people get through recovery.
Right.
But I think it did help with some of the symptoms of withdrawal, the muscle aches, the irritability, the, fast-paced thinking. These are all things that CBD can be very helpful for.
Marcel, let me go back to you. And obviously, we're at the beginnings of trying to understand how CBD works. We've got anecdotes. People have their personal stories about how they feel that it was helpful for them. Help us understand what we need to do scientifically to really look at cause and effect.
Yeah, well, it really comes down to clinical trials, right? Those are the gold standards, these randomized controlled, placebo-controlled trials that are really the gold standard in helping us understand whether something actually works and whether it itself is what works versus, you know, like Max said, other factors that are going on at the same time. So, you know, in the CBD space, there have been those randomized controlled trials in certain areas. So a couple rare forms of pediatric epilepsy. There have been, you know, a number of clinical trials there that have, you know, showed that CBD can reduce seizures in Dravet syndrome and Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, for example, compared to placebo. But when you move beyond pediatric epilepsy, there are a couple studies in anxiety, a lot going on right now. And, you know, as Max was hinting at, you know, there's a number of studies right now that are moving in the direction of looking at how CBD might be helpful with opiate withdrawal or alcohol withdrawal or cocaine addiction, things like that. But again, it's in its infancy, and when we really need those clinical trials to figure that out and funding for those clinical trials. Luckily, the federal government, the National Institutes of Drug Abuse, is spending some money on the addiction angle, trying to see if CBD can be helpful in that domain.
Interesting. You had a piece in JAMA, I guess it was about a year ago, but you looked at some of these CBD products, finding, quote, over and under labeling. What did you find?
Right.
So,
yeah, so in this study, we, you know, we're really interested to know, you know, right now we have, you know, each state has their own sort of laws around around CBD, and there is no federal oversight. And that can be a problem because, you know, the FDA at a federal level is really good at, you know, overseeing production and assuring consistency and accuracy and things like that of products, including foods and otherwise. But they're not really involved in the oversight of the CBD market at the moment. And so we ordered CBD products from a number of different companies and, you know, blinded them and sent them out to a lab to get triplicate tested to really understand, you know, when somebody buys a bottle of CBD, is what's on the label actually what's in the product?
And you found that something like 70% of them, it was incorrect.
Exactly. Yeah. And both sides of the coin. And we gave companies 10% margin of error. So, you know, if you were a little bit over or a little bit under, you know, as long as it was plus or minus 10%, you know, that was considered accurate. But, you know, we saw on both sides of the coin, you know, 70% of folks that were outside of that 10% bracket, some companies having a lot more CBD than they said on the labels, and some companies having significantly less or almost no CBD in products when they said they did.
Is it dangerous to have too much CBD?
CBD in itself, there isn't a whole lot of risk because CBD is pretty safe by itself. The problem is that a lot of these products have other things outside of CBD, and some of those could be problematic at high amounts. So we found, for example, THC, that part that gets you high, at in some cases pretty significant levels in some of these CBD products, and in a lot of cases not labeled on those products. And so if you're a consumer and you're going out and you just want CBD and for, you know, you don't want to have THC, you know, you could be in for a surprise, I guess.
Are we talking about a medicine, a supplement? I'm looking at you, Max. I mean, how do we classify this?
I mean, that's a good question. You know, according to the federal government, you know, marijuana is a level one controlled substance and has no medicinal value. According to, you know, scientists and researchers, yeah, it's having tremendous medicinal value. Right now, I believe it's really like classified as like a nutraceutical product under the FDA. But it doesn't really have classifications at the end of the day. So you're in these tricky guidelines. You know, you're seeing CBD with below 0.1% THC is actually classified as like a, I think a level 5 controlled substance now. And that's considered a, not a food product, but just like it has to have certain classifications. So it's real, there's no regulation on it. And that's really causing a lot of these issues.
And Marcel, does it make it then hard to study it?
Yeah, so CBD, according to the federal government, CBD is a Schedule I substance. The only exception, as Max alluded to, was with a product called Epidiolex. And that specific product, Epidiolex, which is essentially pure CBD, less than 0.1% THC, that has been put into Schedule V, making it a lot easier to not only prescribe, but also to research. But any other CBD at the moment, any other CBD would be Schedule One, which means that doing research on it is quite onerous. You need every site that does a study has to have a Schedule One license, oversight from the DEA, storage and safes, all sorts of different things like that. And it can be pretty expensive and pretty time consuming. So, you know, it's not a barrier per se, but it's definitely something that can, you know, drive people out of this area because it's just so difficult and such a pain to do. This might be changing, though. The Farm Bill, and I don't know if that's, you know, we're going to touch on that, but the Farm Bill is something that, may be passing. It appears to be passing this week, and that might change a bit of how this is dealt with.
Oh, interesting. Let me just quickly reintroduce you both, and that's Marcel Bonn-Miller, obviously joining us by telephone. He's a psychologist, adjunct assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. I'll get that right. And he researches medical marijuana. Max Tuttleman with us here in our Philadelphia studio, chairman of Smart Industry, CEO of Bouquet. It's a CBD company. He's also associate fellow at Thomas Jefferson University doing research on cannabis to be used to deal with things like opioids and alcohol withdrawal. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just put a couple of questions out here. An email from Yimi says, there's a lot of talk of CBD in children with diagnosis for autism. Can the guest speak more on this? Max, you just nodded your head. Go ahead.
I mean, I think this is really Marcel's, a bunch more Marcel's area. But, you know, I do have some parents that give some CBD to their children, and they said it's been groundbreaking and like really helpful.
How many, do you know?
How many children?
Yeah, how many?
I work with four parents with all adult children. And I just, you know, they went to a doctor and their doctor tried to, was prescribing them THC and CBD. They weren't having much success. I'm not an expert on this. I just want to clarify that for any listeners. Like, but in the experience I've had working with these parents, you know, the patients were seeing anxiety with the THC, which makes sense. All of the patients are nonverbal patients. So, you know, I could assume like, you know, if I wasn't able to convey how I was feeling and I'm now feeling all these psychoactive benefits, of course it's going to increase my anxiety. I don't know what's going on. With CBD, they have seen effects, but like they don't know.
But they don't know. Yeah. Marcel, you want to weigh in on that? Do we have Marcel? I think we dropped him, and he got dropped. Okay, we'll try to get him back. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Max, let me go back to you, because we're talking about something that really you say, and so does Marcel Bonn-Miller, said that really we don't have enough true scientific research to really back up these various claims. Nonetheless, we've got a whole market out there. I mean, you can buy this stuff. I was reading an article in 538. There's a doctor. He's in Colorado. He says CBD can deal with pain and inflammation and nausea and vomiting and intestinal cramping, and goes on and on and on and on and on, talking about protecting you against Alzheimer's. And these are really bold claims. They don't seem to be backed up by science at all. Are you concerned that CBD is going to be this snake oil?
Totally. I mean, it's I mean, without scientific data and without like real proof, like you really can't be making claims. And it's like it'll gain the perception of snake oil. And then, you know, you start listing these different conditions you just list. And it's like, wow. Like,
whatever ails you.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, at the end of the day, like trying to really just get these – like get the research done has been very difficult. You know, the funding for this research is very scarce. You know, through my family's foundation, we've been funding Jefferson University. Jefferson really took an incredible leap of faith by creating one of the first cannabis research institutes in the United States. And the doctor, Dr. Charlie Pollack, that leads it up, has really collected incredible researchers from all around the world and is really like aggregating them at Jefferson and trying to create this like scientific hub of cannabis knowledge. And, you know, but like I think it was besides my family's foundation, there was only a couple other like cornerstone funders. There was one big funder that came in at $10 million. But like at the end of the day, we need like, you know, if people like listeners are curious about like what CBD can do and are really passionate about it and really think they can help them, the best thing they could probably do is write like a $10 check to like a university or, you know, MAPS who does incredible research to like support this kind of work, because we're not seeing the government step in and do it. And it's going to take private citizens and private organizations to really push this thing forward.
What about, I know it's some of these products are made in America, including yours, and some are made in China. And I was reading that the stuff from China, beware.
Yep. Well, I mean, America has the best farmers in the world, so I don't know why we would grow hemp anywhere else but the United States. You know, I really think hemp can help reinvigorate American tobacco fields, American corn fields, can really help, like, you know, create like a bio-based economy. And, you know, hemp can be used as a fuel source. It can be used as an energy source. It can that opportunities in a sustainable ecosystem where a bio-based product like hemp or corn is really being developed into the future and really like trying to, you know, take over the petroleum economy, there's endless possibility. There's endless jobs and there's endless growth.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about CBD, and it's being sold in a number of products. You can use it in, or it's being sold in things like ice cream and drinks that you can have, but it's not really regulated, and we're talking about the pros and cons. You can join us, and I guess cons is you can use that several different ways. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and we've been talking about something called CBD. It's a chemical that occurs naturally in the cannabis plant. It does not deliver that high of THC, and it's being promoted, sometimes over-promoted, to deal with a variety of physical and psychological conditions. And again, our guests are Marcel Bonn-Miller. He's a psychologist, adjunct assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, and he researches medical marijuana. Max Tuttleman, chairman of Smart Industries and associate fellow at Thomas Jefferson University, doing research on cannabis, used to deal with opioid and alcohol withdrawal. Let me go back to you, Marcel, and hopefully we have you hooked up with us again. What kind of research do you think should be, I guess, top priority in terms of what we should be investing in to understand the impact, the effects of CBD?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's widespread. The problem is that the upside is that CBD has a lot of potential across a lot of different conditions. You know, you mentioned autism before. That's one that, you know, I think is honestly, if I had to pick the next big research push that's going to happen or that's currently happening, I think it's in autism.
Really? Interesting.
And related conditions to that. Yeah. What was epilepsy, you know, the big push in epilepsy and our understanding of pediatric epilepsy and the impact of CBD on that, is now, I think, shifting, now that we have a decent handle on it, it's shifting to autism. And actually, Autism Speaks, the nonprofit foundation, just put together a roundtable a couple weeks ago, bringing together all the experts that are doing this work to sit down and talk about what we know and where we need to go from here. So I think it's very promising. I think post-traumatic stress disorder is another condition that's getting increased attention. I do a bunch of work in that area as well. Mm. So there are lots of different conditions, you know, and addiction, like was mentioned before, opiate addiction, alcohol withdrawal, things like that, I think are another area that is going to receive a lot of attention or is, you know, in the next couple of years.
But as you know, Marcel, and I was talking with Max about this, I mean, it is being sold to deal with every possible affliction, physical, psychological, that a person right. could have. And in some cases, people are paying money for what it appears to be snake oil.
Right. Yeah, and that's the, you know, and I think that, you know, there's really kind of two different groups, right? There's the folks that are using it medicinally, that are really trying to help, you know, kids with epilepsy, kids with autism, you know, individuals with PTSD. And then there's another segment that's kind of the wellness segment. And I think those are two distinct segments. You know, when you talk about, I think you mentioned, you know, CBD infused, name it, right? Salsa, protein powder, coffee. That's more in the wellness market. And I think that there's not a whole lot of evidence right now to support any of that. For a number of different reasons, but it's important to kind of separate that out from, you know, what's going on in the medicinal space and the real potential that this has as a medicine.
And you see real potential there.
I do. You know, I think the early data, you know, I mean, we know pediatric epilepsy, certain rare forms of pediatric epilepsy it works for. We have some really compelling early data on autism and related conditions to autism, like Fragile X, and with PTSD as well. There's some early data that are pretty positive. Again, we're not quite at the stage we are with pediatric epilepsy, but we're getting there quickly. And I think there are a lot of dollars that are heading in the right direction, but of course we need more. These trials are very expensive to do.
Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Emily calling us from Phoenixville. And Emily, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my question.
You're welcome.
My question is about dosage, and but your experts were talking earlier about that each state is managing CBD oil. There's no consistency with labeling, but they were both talking about that they see some impact of CBD oil, and I'm wondering if they could talk about the impact they're seeing and what those dosages are like, because the dosages are so hugely varied when you go to shop for CBD oil. It's sort of confusing.
Sure. Emily, I appreciate the call. Max, can I toss that first to you?
Yeah. So I think really, you know, this is a tough question, Emily, because like we've been talking about through the episode, like we don't really have the evidence base showing like what doses help with what. I always recommend starting small and then gradually increasing until you start seeing the desired effect that you'd be looking for or targeting. And, you know, if you're not seeing that desired effect after, you know, so X amount of increases, you know, you may be – it's not going to work for you. But, yeah, that's how I would probably handle it.
How would you handle it, Marcel?
Well, I mean, we do know dosing information for some things. So pediatric epilepsy, and I know I keep coming back to that, but that's really where our largest evidence base is. You know, your dosing, they're pretty high doses that have been shown to be effective. So, you know, we're talking starting out at 5 milligrams per kilogram and going up to 20 milligrams per kilogram plus. So that's a lot of CBD per day that we're talking about. As you move into other conditions like anxiety, you know, there have been some studies, you know, where you're looking at doses in kids starting at around 250 milligrams and going up to 500 plus milligrams. You're also seeing for anxiety, similarly, 600 milligrams or so. So it's, you know, that's about where we're at. It's definitely in the hundreds of milligrams of CBD. The trick is the other stuff that's in it and how much that complicates or impacts the pure dosing of CBD, because most of these clinical trials that have looked at dosing have just looked at CBD, pure CBD. And so when you get extracts, CBD oil, they have other things in them that may impact dosing a little bit. But, I mean, I agree with Max, start low, but you want to make sure that you can get high enough so that you can, if there is going to be an impact, that you would be able to see it.
Is it on the label, though, Marcel? I mean, so that you know in a bottle how much of that is CBD oil?
Yeah, I mean, if you trust the label, yes.
But how would you trust?
There should be in there.
Trust but verify,
right?
That's
where, you know, exactly. I mean, you can ask companies to have, you know, to get independent reports of their testing. You want to make sure that they're batch testing so that you can look at your label and have a batch number on it and be able to ask for the testing information of that batch. And then beyond that, you know, if I were... I mean, because of the lack of regulation, if I were working with a child that was, a vulnerable population, for example, a child with some intractable epilepsy, I would probably send it out myself for independent testing, which is a whole extra complicated part of this. But importantly, when you talk about these, you know, beyond the, you know, let's assume for a second that the labels are correct and you're going in and you're like, all right, well, I'm going to start at 200 milligrams a day. That's a lot of product. Most of these products, some of the bottles have 500 in the whole bottle, right? So, you know, it can be quite costly if you're dealing with the doses that at the moment have been shown to be likely efficacious in some of these conditions.
Let me read some more comments. An email from Carol. I work at an anxiety clinic and recently have had young adolescents admitted whose parents are giving them CBD drops every day for their anxiety. Then she has a question, recommended? And again, I should say to our listeners and also to our guests is we are not here on the air prescribing CBD one way or the other. We're really just exploring what we know about it and what we need to learn about it. But I'd just be curious, Max, your thoughts.
One of the reasons I started using this was for anxiety. And when I started doing that, I was actually reading our other guest's paper. And Marcel is like one of the leaders on anxiety and marijuana. So I'm going to let him speak on that.
Okay, Marcel, go ahead.
You're too nice, Max. But I think there is definitely evidence to show that CBD can reduce anxiety, and that evidence is mounting. There needs to be more of it and more of these clinical trials like I talked about. But it appears to be an anxiolytic, which is good. THC has the opposite effect, particularly in high doses. So that THC that gets you high or is responsible for the high in the cannabis plant can actually, at high doses, increase anxiety. So it's important to really know what's in your product. And really be, you know, specific about what you're using. You know, what I like to say is cannabis is not cannabis is not cannabis. There's so much variation here. But if you're looking at high CBD products, you know, there's decent evidence and building evidence to show that it could help with anxiety.
Here's an email from Liz. Is there any place a consumer can get information, re the quality of a product? Amazon sells all different kinds, and we're back to this. There's a certain theme here, Max, right, about just that. How do you know that what you're getting is what is in the bottle?
You know, I'd reach out to the manufacturers and ask for a certificate of analysis and say, hey, like, I'd like to see the testing for this batch and really would like to understand it. And honestly, they should have no problem handing it over.
Is it, though, harmful at low doses, or is it just that you're wasting your money? I mean,
harmful at low doses?
Yeah. I mean, is CBD, is it harmful? Is it harmful?
No, I don't think it's harmful. Yeah.
Do you think it's harmful, Marcel?
No, I mean, if we're talking pure CBD, there isn't a lot of risk, which is a good thing. The problem is not only wasting your money, like you mentioned, if you have a product that has little to no CBD in it, but also, you know, if this is the last stop on a long journey of trying medication out for your child or for yourself, it would be awful to see somebody say, oh, I tried CBD and it didn't work, when in fact they tried something that they thought was CBD, but it wasn't, or it didn't have enough of it in it to get an effect. Because this is something that could be helpful for some conditions for which traditional medications don't work. And so, you know, knowing that you're actually getting a sufficient dose and getting the actual product, I think would be, you know, is important.
Here's an email from Hillary. How are companies changing their drug policy when it comes to medical marijuana and CBD, since THC stays in your body for an extended period of time and will cause a hot drug test? And I guess it does get to this question about, you know, interaction with either other pharmaceuticals, but also with THC. Do you want to weigh in on that, Max?
You know, I believe what they're referring to is like drug testing on applications. And I believe there was recently a federal court ruling around this. I'm not sure. But, you know, the way I look at it is like, you know, if someone has, you know, we have a terrible opiate epidemic going on right now. But if someone has a legitimate reason and a prescription to take opiates, that wouldn't preclude them from having a job. So I don't see why there would be any discrimination towards marijuana and marijuana types of medicine.
A tweet from Maya. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Marcel.
Just a quick little comment on that is that we're doing a study right now that's actually looking at CBD products, and most CBD products have at least a little bit of THC. It does accumulate in the body over time, and we are seeing people, even if they're low percentages of THC in them, screen positive on drug tests, you know, folks that have been using CBD regularly, you know, purchasing the oils or whatever in dispensaries or online. So it's definitely an important consideration, whether it's right for, you know, for there to be backlash if you test positive. That's a separate issue, but it's just something people should be aware of, is that there is definitely a real likelihood that you could test positive.
Sure, here's a tweet. Sure, here's a tweet from Maya. I don't feel like it's fair to lump pain management and help with nausea together in a list of wild claims that include preventing Alzheimer's. There is research for these uses with cancer patients and absolutely no downside to trying it now. Marcel, I'm back to you. Agree, disagree?
Well, right. I mean, when you look at the conditions for which, you know, cannabis, you know, medical cannabis has been legalized, it's, you get the gamut. And it's not all evidence-based. And like the person said, you know, there is more evidence in certain areas than others. For pain and nausea, that's actually THC is where the research is on that, not CBD. And there are, you know, definitely negative consequences associated with THC for some people. So it's important to THC isn't as safe as CBD. So important to consider that, and also important to understand the nuances there, where, you know, for CBD, you know, there's a little bit on pain, but not a whole lot right now showing efficacy, whereas for THC, it seems to be really helpful. And same thing for nausea. That's really a THC issue.
Fair enough. Here's an email from Brian. I've been listening to the discussion and wanted to caution against the suggestion that CBD is a brand new mystery compound unsupported by research. It's not. And lots of scholarly research has been conducted in places like Israel for decades on the efficacy of CBD as a treatment in a variety of therapeutic areas. Max, let me give you a chance to weigh in on Brian's comment.
Yeah, he's absolutely right. There has been incredible work done in Israel for the past 50 years. You know, they've had the regulatory ability to study this substance relatively easily. I go over there very often and work with different universities, especially at the Technion University, which is like the MIT of Israel. And they're doing incredible work there and really understanding the purification and the analysis aspect of it. So understanding what different photocannabinoids and what flavonoids are present in the plant and how they're working. And
trying to figure out whether it deals with all these things that we have been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, there's study going on. I mean, I saw everything from, you know, is it helping with breast cancer? Is it killing breast cancer cells? To, you know, transference of in breast milk to babies, and how much is really like the residual amounts of THC or CBD in breast milks and how it's transferred to a child. And they have the patient pool, because there's a very extensive medical marijuana program there, and it's with actually very strict restrictions on prescribing, much stricter here than the United States. But you know, go ahead, sorry, Marcel.
And we're almost out of time there, Marcel. But go ahead very briefly.
Sorry, Max. Just to add, though, that it's just important to differentiate the level of – so I agree there's lots of great stuff going on in Israel. The problem is that it's the placebo-controlled clinical trials that are lacking. So, you know, we don't differentiate from research. research perspective where the study's gone on. There has been a lot of research, but we need to move it into the clinical trial space before we know it's actually effective, and before we understand dosing. And that's what's been missing. While there's been other research observational looking at medical cannabis patients or things in petri dishes or things in animals, we really need to move that more towards the clinical trial space.
And clinical trials include looking at the placebo effect. Yep. Marcel Bonn Miller, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Max Tuttleman, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.